It's October 4th, 2025, by Gary Monastery. Nat, we had a really good meeting with our pilgrimage group today, our India pilgrimage group. So the Vaigiri, some of the monastic and lay community, we plan to visit the Buddhist holy sites in India from November 1st to 23rd. And also right now, we are nearing the end of our Vasa period. So it's October 4th, and then October 7th is the Pavarana day. And then at dawn on October 8th is when we technically are out of the Vasa period, the rains retreat period. And the weather has been very good, and it has been raining a bit on and off. The air is very, very clean right now, very clear, and it's very quiet outside, and just the weather is just perfect right now. Sometimes there's a bit of a cool breeze, and then you walk in the forest and smell the bay laurel after the rain, and everything is just like medicine, just very clean and clear, pure. So it's okay to enjoy this. This can give rise to a sense of enjoyment in being in the forest, living in this area. And that sense of enjoyment can inform our practice, can help the meditation. So the Buddha says in the suttas that the happy mind is easily concentrated, and so we need to find ways to gladden the mind, bring happiness to the mind. And it's not the happiness that comes from the burst of gratification that we get from indulging in any kind of sensuality, whether it's from having a good meal or listening to music that we like or whatever. That's not the type of the happiness that the Buddha's referring to, but it's the happiness of the clear mind. And it's the happiness that comes from a blameless type of enjoyment. So we can make use of this time, make use of the good environment too. It's not to say we don't have gratitude for good food and so on. We do have good food here. We're very well supported. But to not become intoxicated by it, because that sense of intoxication will reduce the enjoyment that we feel. It'll reduce the gladdening of the mind that we can experience if we reflect on the Dhamma. And Vajinachalo gave a talk for about half an hour at the beginning of our Zoom meeting today. And he gave encouragement and helped to inspire us to go on our pilgrimage. And, you know, he's talking a lot about India and almost being like going to another planet. And it's so much different. However, if we go with spiritual aspirations, it's just such a... I really liked what he said about, you know, everybody has a god in India. So even the rickshaw drivers will have some sort of deity, like a sticker or a little statue of some deity in the front of their vehicle, which they will do a puja for in the morning time and offer incense. And they might have a chant or a mantra associated with it. So there may even be deities that we've never heard of, but it brings that realm closer to the surface because everybody has a god in India. So it brings heaven closer to earth just through 1.5 billion people doing their pujas in the mornings and taking some sort of deity as the center of their life. It doesn't mean that everybody has sila, doesn't mean that everybody has virtue, but it does have this effect of bringing this spiritual energy to the country. And so that's something you come into contact with in India. And it's loud and noisy, and on the roads there's horns honking all the time, and it can be very loud in these holy sites that we visit, but there are quiet times. There are these precious moments, and just being outside just before this, doing walking meditation and listening to the crickets and just enjoying the perfect weather, seeing the full moon coming up, or the nearly full moon coming up. Then it's coming back to me that there was these quiet moments in the evening times in Bodh Gaya. Sometimes either people would be going to eat dinner, or just people would disperse temporarily, and there might be a monk doing a long chant on a loudspeaker, kind of going in the background. But otherwise, it would it would go quiet and there'd be good weather, cool breeze. And sometimes those evenings at the Bodhi tree were quite peaceful. The environment would become quite peaceful. So I found myself looking forward to those experiences again. So it's like if you do the practice and put up with all the difficulties that might be there in Bodh Gaya, say that you might have these hordes of people, the hundreds and of, say, the Sri Lankan pilgrims, they'll travel in groups of 200 or 300. They actually travel there by boat and train, and you'll have 300 white-clad Sri Lankan grannies coming to pay respects to the Bodhi tree. And you'll be sitting there trying to meditate, and you'll just feel kind of buffeted back and forth by these Sri Lankan grannies and paying respects. And so, or you might have the Burmese groups coming and paying respects and with loudspeakers that are turned up way too loud. And there's only 6 or 7 people in their group, and it's just this loudspeaker is blaring away and you can't even tell what they're saying. It's just turned up to the maximum, and they set it right next to you while you're trying to meditate. Or you have the dogs, like one session where I was there wanting to get going with my meditation and set my mat out and do my first morning 2.5 hour meditation, get up to use the restroom, come back, and there's a dog sleeping on my meditation mat. So I kind of tried to poke it with my foot and move it off, and it wasn't getting up. It was very comfortable there. And so I kind of nudged it a little bit harder and it yelped, and then it peed on my meditation mat as it ran off, kind of in order. So I kind of looked at it for a bit and just flipped it over and kept sitting. But if we put up with these obstacles that can arise, then you get those moments of, oh, there's not many people around. Oh, it's quiet. Really nice feeling, really nice energy. So it's not just like that in Bodh Gaya, but it's like that everywhere. So we might practice and we might think, well, if I lead a life of meditation, it's going to be peaceful and easy and wonderful. And we might meditate once and get hooked on meditation because we have a peaceful experience. We feel happy and content. So we decide to start meditating more often. But then we find it's not so easy and we can't really get back to what we experienced. That experience that hooked us in the beginning, we can't really get back to it. And so, but we persevere and we put a lot of effort into the meditation, put a lot of effort into practice. And we might decide to follow the precepts, the 5 precepts or the 8 precepts. And over time, if we persevere, then we will have those peaceful and wonderful moments again. But it takes work and it doesn't happen all the time. It's like if we work at a job, it's not payday every day. It just happens once in a while. We get paid once in a while. And then we should save up our money. We should be skillful with our money. We shouldn't just splurge it. We shouldn't just go crazy, go wild, use it all up. Then we're just left with square one. We're left with nothing again. So we have those good moments, but then just to hold them precious to ourselves, we don't have to go and talk about them to everybody. Our good experiences, if we talk about our good experiences in practice, then it dissipates them. They're no longer as precious. If we have a conflict with somebody and we talk through that with them, that's a good thing. That also dissipates it. So it's good to talk through the bad things. They happen. It's good to smooth things over. But then to keep the good things precious and not reveal them too much, that's important. And then to build it up. So throughout the day in Bodh Gaya, hear all sorts of different people chanting. Some of the chanting is really awful. Some of the chanting that you might hear is really dissonant and not melodious. And some of it might be very grating. Or sometimes you might have people doing circumambulations who are chanting very loudly and it sounds horrible. But then you just, okay, it's just sound. And these people are expressing their devotion. They might not know, they might be tone deaf. They might not know how they sound. So give rise to a sense of gratitude, compassion, patient endurance. And then there'll be those times where it's just hauntingly beautiful melodies, hauntingly beautiful chanting. when you're not expecting it. Sometimes things may be difficult. Sometimes in our life of practice, things may be difficult. Obstacles may arise. Things may seem very unpleasant. The people we live with may seem very unpleasant. We just endure, we persevere. And then there'll be those times where we notice the good and we notice the beautiful. And then in that moment, the mind is gladdened. Everything seems good in that moment. Sometimes things are difficult for a long time, and then things change a bit, things shift a bit, and then we get this respite. We get the respite from the difficult, and we're able to relax for a bit, finally. And sometimes we practice and the knees hurt, the back hurts. This is in the suttas, the Bhikkhu Samyutta, or the just no-name Bhikkhu is asking questions of the Buddha, a Bhikkhu going to the Buddha and saying, "Lord, my knees hurt when I meditate. What do I do?" It's just like today. It's no different. I'm trying to meditate. My knees hurt. What do I do? So it's the Buddha giving just this practical advice. So, well, you can try to push through it a little bit, but you don't want to injure yourself. You can try to do walking meditation. You can endure for a bit, and then you can do a change of posture, do the walking meditation. I'm just giving basic practical advice for bhikkhus whose knees were hurting. Now, nothing has changed. That being said, when the mind becomes glad, then that can change things considerably. It's actually amazing how much of our bodily pain is really tied into our mental states, more specifically our unwholesome mental states, and that when the mind is gladdened, how it really lightens things in so many ways. It's not that it makes our bodily pain disappear, but it seems to make it more endurable. And when the mind is glad, then we're not trying to get out of that. We're not looking for a way out of that. When the mind is suffering, then we're looking for a way out of that. So there's a lot of thinking. There's a lot of pondering and proliferating about how to get out of this suffering. But when the mind is glad, there's not as much proliferation because we're happy to be there. We don't need to go anywhere else. So when the mind is gladdened, we're happy to be there in the moment. So it's no wonder that the Buddha says the happy mind is easily concentrated, because the happy mind is happy to be there. It's not trying to get anywhere else. So of course it's going to settle. Of course it's going to lead to samadhi. Of course it's the prerequisite. So when we understand things in this way, then we'll understand that meditation isn't about clamping down as hard as we can, putting as much intense effort as we can into a meditation object, because that leads to more tension. We want the natural settling to happen in the mind. But it's difficult because that doesn't just mean we take it easy. Natural settling doesn't happen just from taking it easy. We do have to put balanced effort into things. So that's where the daily schedule in the monastery comes in. Getting up, going to morning puja, doing the chanting, doing the meditation, maybe dealing with some drowsiness, dealing with some tiredness, cleaning the monastery for half an hour, the morning chores, 6:30 to 7, having a light breakfast, some coffee, tea, a drink in the morning, morning reflection, morning Dhamma reflection, a short work period. So that's building up that sense of service or dana, generosity, open afternoon where we might engage in, after the meal, engaging in sitting and walking meditation, maybe taking a short rest. And whatever we go through during our practice in the morning or the afternoon, it's not always going to be settled. It's not always going to be easy, but it's our attitude toward it where we learn how to put our heart into any activity, how we relate to all of these activities throughout the day, putting our heart into it and focusing in the moment on doing a good job. If we're able to do that, then that's going to inform how we relate to our meditation practice. If we're just trying to get onto the next thing so we can get to our kuti and meditate, and we have that energy of just trying to get to the next thing, then when we sit down to meditate, then inevitably the mind is going to still have that energy of trying to just get onto the next thing. And it's not going to be peaceful. So developing skill is all about developing it in every posture and every activity. And then at those times when we have to speak and interact with each other, then maybe being able to catch ourselves sometimes. Okay, now it's time to end this conversation, and maybe it's now it's time for solitude. Conversation, especially if it's wholesome, if it's around Dhamma, it can be pleasant. Exchanging ideas about practice or just enjoying the company of others. This can be pleasant. This is the throat chakra is connected with joy. So talking a lot can be enjoyable, can bring us a type of pleasure, but we have to be careful to not be too dependent on it. If we're too dependent on talking to get a sense of pleasure, then we'll just be talking all the time, talking nonstop. So in terms of the practice or monastic practice, there's these three dhammas. They're called the Apanika dhammas, or the dhammas that are never wrong. And these are all lifted up in the Thai forest tradition quite a bit. This is eating little, speaking little, sleeping little, eat little, speak little, sleep little, practice a lot. Doesn't mean don't eat, don't sleep, don't speak. Doesn't mean that, but just the right amount. Just the amount that's going to be useful. Try to reduce the amount of food just a bit. Doesn't have to be a lot, just a bit. What's the effect? What's the effect on the body, the mind? Does it become lighter? Does it become easier to meditate? Do you feel more healthy? Try speaking just less. It doesn't have to be no speaking, but just speaking less. And then when other people are speaking around us, we don't need to become critical of them, but just for ourselves, just we can have that quiet inner smile. We have a quiet inner smile where we can delight in the practice of speaking less and sleeping less, just reducing our sleep just a bit. And we have the optional lunar observance days where there always is kind of a core group who are staying up. But apart from that, just the daily practice of if we tend to take a rest in the middle of the day, try to rest a little bit shorter time, see what the benefit, there will be many benefits to this. Sleep, it can be a way that we just get away from the suffering temporarily. But then if we sleep too much, it'll increase our suffering. It'll compound the problem. And the mind will be murky. It won't be clear. It won't be gladdened. If we sleep just the right amount, the mind will be glad and refreshed. Body and mind will both be refreshed. So eating little, speaking little, sleeping little, this is doing things in the right measure, knowing the right measure, knowing the right amount. Matanutas, knowing the right measure of things. Kalanutas, knowing the right time to do certain things. The Buddha actually forbade the monks from making a complete vow of silence. This is called the Mukhavata. And in certain ascetics in India would vow to never speak, to have a vow of complete silence. The Buddha said it's good to speak at the right time and necessary to speak at the right time, but we don't have to speak much. So here we like to, sometimes we like to talk a lot and plan things quite a bit. One of the benefits I found being in Thailand is learning about people who just do. So sometimes the Thais, they just get things done. They don't have to talk about it a lot. They don't have to plan it out, go to the drawing board. They just get it done. This Lompar Pasano gave the example of this Buddha Rupa arriving at Wapananachat, and it's quite heavy and big. And so a lot of the Western monks gather and, well, how are we going to move this thing into place? And we kind of maybe have to secure it this way and get some ropes this way and kind of maybe here we'll kind of use a platform to kind of get it in place. And by the time they were done talking, the Thais already had it in place. They just picked it up and, you know, they just grabbed 20 people and moved the thing. So that's a good example. Sometimes it doesn't have to be the most efficient way. We don't have to do things in the most convenient, most efficient way. We just have to do things in a way that's good enough, get things done. Sometimes we have to take a long time to do something. I was working with Tanhimiko and Anagarika Andreas this morning, just getting one board cut. We spent the entire morning planing some boards, but then just really finishing just one board and just having, it's big and kind of having to move tools around. But that's what it takes sometimes. It just takes time just to do one thing. But there's no rush, and we just put our heart into every aspect of the activity, every step of the way. And then we end up creating something beautiful. So the practice is really like that. When we do the chanting, We can actually focus on the syllables of the chanting, trying to harmonize with the people next to us. We can use the chanting as a meditation object. We can quote Lompo Pisano again, saying that he surprised himself by the mind was able to go into a state of fairly deep peace while chanting. So it's not an obstacle. That's just these reflections on Dhamma that we do. They can be used as the meditation object as well. So there's a lot that we can do here to gladden the mind, but also being careful to not be too intoxicated. If the mind does get gladdened, sometimes there can be that impulse to try to more, make it more and more glad. But once the mind is gladdened, that's good enough to have that attitude that, okay, well, if there's a sense of bubbly piti sukha, joy, rapture, happiness, that's good. And that's actually an enlightenment factor that the Buddha raised up and made much of. But then relating to it in a way that it goes to peace rather than more and more excitement. Sometimes it happens that everybody is happy in the monastery, so then that erupts into ebullient talk. And that's actually wholesome. However, it's even more wholesome, even better, to bring it to a state of peace. Just kind of keep it inside and transmute it into the meditation practice. Then it's really good. So these are a few reflections just coming up from having the meeting today and listening to Ajahn Acilo and reflecting on India and kind of trying to bring it into some of the ways we practice here at Abhayagiri. So I think I'll just leave it fairly short this evening. It's been a long day, so I think I'll leave it there.